Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 186 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, it's the return of the Media Pit with Zach and Michael, and we have a special guest. Mike Vandenham is joining us in the Media Pit. It was great to catch up with him, and we'll get to that conversation in just a minute, right after I tell you about our sponsor for the show, which is Works. I know you guys are doing a lot of online shopping these days, and one of the best places to gear up on all of your tool needs is yourcleanbike.com. That's where you can get the Works HydroShot, which is a great pressure washer that is portable, that we've used a ton during the cyclocross season and hope to use again in the future. But when you're stuck at home, they also have a ton of tools on that page also that'll help you with all those home projects that you have the time to get to now. So go to yourcleanbike.com, put in the promo code GEARUP, all caps, G-E-A-R-U-P. You're going to get 15% off of everything that is in your checkout cart, courtesy of your friends here at the Wide Angle Podium Network. And talking about the Wide Angle Podium Network, go to wideanglepodium.com. Check out all of the shows that we have there. People have been just pumping out great content. If you're looking for video content to go along with your podcast, go to youtube.com/cxhairs and check out The Rough Draft. It's a weekly video show been putting on with the guys in the Media Pit along with Tim from the Slow Ride podcast. That's been a lot of fun, and we would love for you to watch that and share it and like it and subscribe to the channel and all of that other great stuff. Okay, under 2 minutes here on the intro. That's like an all-new record for me. So let's get to the show. This is Mike Vandenham and the Media Pit, and we're doing it right now. Like, all right, we are in the Media Pit, and we have a special guest with us, our Canadian correspondent. Can we do that? Can we just have one Canadian correspondent?
The favorite Canadian is here. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. Second favorite Canadian.
Second favorite. Come on now. Second favorite. Let's make sure that we're...
The only Canadian on the Media Pit. Ever, maybe. So I don't know. I think the math kind of adds up. Favorite Canadian.
Michael Vandenham's here. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Hello, I'm great. How are you guys?
We're hanging in there. We're hanging in there. This is the part where we pretend that we haven't been talking for the last 30 minutes. Hey, Michael, look, I've been out of this so long. Zach, I don't even know if he's prepared. So that we're all going to find out together. Michael, how's it going?
Bill, it's pretty rough. You know, I'm podcasting outside, but there's quite a draft coming off the river. Real rough draft going on over here.
Nice.
I just had to wing that one because I forgot about my punny intros.
Michael, hey guys. Can I point something out? We recorded that show on Monday. this is a different show, Michael.
Zach, it's called a Svenergy. I'm doing a plug for a show that I edited called The Rough Draft, episode 1.5. Zach, you're on it. Bill, you're on it. Michael, you're going to be on it soon. I hate to tell you this, but you made the doc, but you got cut.
I am only too well aware. If everyone goes and watches The Rough Draft and zooms in, they'll see this nice little thing called the ham cam. And they'll eagerly watch the entire 7 minutes of video, and there will be no ham cam. No ham cam at all.
Do you want to know?
What was it? Who knows?
Do you want to know why it got cut? I can only imagine, but I know for my part that I compared you to Chuck Knobloch.
That's right.
Yeah, 80s baseball references. 80s baseball references get cut automatically.
The only sports references you can make right now are about the 6-time championship winning Bulls, I think. That's it. The only ones that are on.
That really is like the only sport that's being done.
Well, it's not being done. It was being done like 25 years ago.
I will say, though, I appreciated you had a nice AI reference. You're kind of getting the vibe of the Media Pit, like basketball references. Always welcome.
It's a step out of my comfort zone. I'm a big hockey fan. Like, I'm a medium hockey fan, big enough that I like subscribe to The Athletic. I think you have to be a little deep in to be doing that, but I don't like watch every single game or anything.
So Canucks?
No. The Evil Empire, the Leafs.
Oh, so you and Scotty are on the same yeah. page. Okay.
I know, and it breaks our hearts every time around this year when the Bruins come in and stomp on us. And I'm holding out hope that maybe it wouldn't have happened this year, and maybe it still won't happen. But it's super sad every year when I go into the pits, and I think it's Waterloo in Iowa, and Scott Kelly's there wearing his Bruins jersey because he lost a bet to Stu. And it's like a child size, extra small, doesn't really fit him. But there he is wearing it.
Michael and Zach, do you all know that this actually happened with Stu Thorne from, you know, Cannondale? Oh. From
wait, so Boston. Stu is the Bruins fan, and yeah. then who is Scotty's team?
So Scott Kelly.
Scott Kelly's a Leafs fan. Yeah,
so he's the mechanic of Norco now, I guess, but also Team Canada for cyclocross, and he's worked with Cliff Pro team.
But wait, Michael. So, Michael, you're a Leafs fan? Like,
I know,
how does that
crazy?
How does that work?
I'll give you the backstory because it makes no sense, right? So, I grew up in Manitoba. I grew up in this like window where the Winnipeg Jets. If you're not a hockey fan, you're like, I don't care who the Winnipeg Jets are. But they disappeared and they went to Phoenix, which is terrible. But then about like 10 years ago, they came back. They moved the franchise out of Atlanta. But I grew up in this window where there was no hockey team or no NHL team in Manitoba. So I just like kind of, I don't know, as a child, I must have just picked the jerseys that I think looked the coolest. And it happened to be the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I've just stuck with them. I've tried to cheer for other teams, tried to cheer for the Jets, tried to cheer for the Canucks. I just can't get into it. Like I'm a born and bred Leafs fan now. And Leafs fans are the worst people. They're like the Yankees fans or like the Patriots fans. Like nobody likes Leafs fans, but I'm one of them. What are you going to do about it?
But wait, so like by Canadian standards, that probably makes them entirely reasonable and decent and friendly, right? Or are they really bad? Like, is this like the dark side of Canada?
The comment section of articles about the Leafs is the dark side of Canada. You want to see Canadians getting mad? Go to the comment section of like a Sportsnet. That's our ESPN. Of a Leafs article, and it's just sheer hate.
I think, Zach, you need to go to get a true sense of the real Canada. You know, you need to go to like Mount St. Anne and have that experience to sort of wash your mind of like the nice gentle Canadian.
But wait, what happens at Mount St. Anne? Like, what's
everything?
Wow,
the rowdiest the rowdiest race.
I guess you can go on Mike's side of the country too, and go for Whistler.
Yeah, Whistler's its own thing. I think people are generally nice there. They're just like the park rattiest park rats in the universe.
like
I don't know how else to describe it.
All the crank works, Whistler.
For sure,
gets
it's like guaranteed.
Nuts.
75% of the people in Crankworks are out there to shred the gnar and live in their van with their trail dog. Like, no questions asked. That's just what they do.
I actually, in this day and age, I'll take it. I'd embrace it. I would go tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be, I think Crankworks has been officially off the docket right now. And that's sort of sad.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
cool thing.
So I, as much as we really haven't been, or at least in the version, the non-media pit versions of this podcast, I've kind of strayed away from the real world, I guess. But, you race bikes for a living, and this is affecting you. So what's the outlook that right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think one of the toughest things about this is trying not to get too carried away with what the outlook could be. You can only spend so much time thinking and worrying about something. And I've heard it a few times now, but there's the saying, you focus on what you can control and try not to worry about everything else. And that's a whole lot easier said than done, obviously, but that's sort of where I'm at. I think for me, a lot of this has allowed me to dive into training maybe a little bit more than I have before. I think the life of a bike racer, especially someone who's doing gravel and cyclocross like I do, we're kind of bouncing around all over the place. So as much as I wish it was in very different circumstances, something about spending all this time at home has been nice. It's been different. You know, I don't think I've spent this much extended time at home in years. So, but as far as the racing itself goes, yeah, I'm, I'm missing being out there. It seems like every weekend now you're seeing like, hey, this event should have happened this weekend and this event should have happened this weekend. So it's missing, you know, missing those events and missing all the people is really tough. But one thing that has helped a little bit is trying to dive into the, like, just the process of everything and trying to get better as an athlete. And something cool that I've sort of realized through all this is that I really love racing and I really love the people there and I really love competing, but I also just really, really like training and going through those steps and trying to be the best athlete that I can be. And, you know, I'm definitely building towards a goal some point down the road, but being involved in that process, as cliche as that sounds, is really fulfilling as well. If I wake up every day and go, you know what, this is what I'm doing for training. This is what I want to get out of it. Not only is it like providing a little bit of a purpose in every day, but it's also helping to keep moving forward in this time when like there's not very much stuff that seems stable.
Yeah, I completely understand that. That's sort of where I was with athletics, and it hit home like the last couple of years. This year especially, I've been coaching my daughter who's 12, her basketball team. And I used to love, like, the thing that I loved about basketball, and it sort of like flows over into Svenness and all that, is I loved practice and I loved all mm-hmm. of the learning how to do stuff. So like being in a gym just for that, you know, coaching time that we had, like having a whole gym to ourselves for an hour with just these 12-year-old girls, like learning how to play basketball. That's like, I was like, this is what I miss. This is like the coolest part. It's like the games are cool. You know, everybody loves that, but like this actually is a ton of fun. So I can see that. And it does look, I mean, just following you on social media, it looks like you are having fun with it. You are enjoying, like, you know, honing skills and like learning how to wheelie and or better and doing all those kinds of things.
No. It's learning how to wheelie, period. I don't know. I just never learned as a kid. And then you get to the point, right, when you're like 18 or 20 or whatever it is, and you're trying to train and race and it's like, this skill is a waste of time. Like, what do I need to know how to wheelie for? But I just always felt like hanging out with all the kids at the Cycling Canada projects and on the team. And they're all like, you know, Bridget, Julie, my teammate, she's like doing all these cool skills videos and all this stuff. I'm like, I can't do any of that. Like, I'm old.
I feel like the, you know, the kids are the ones that we always see doing it, you know, so you're kind of the established pro, and you've got,
I know,
kids literally like doing wheelies in circles around you.
No, you say that sort of in joke, but like we were riding around Belgium and two of the juniors, I was riding with them, and they're both doing wheelies, and one of them, you know, grabs the signpost and does a full circle around. I'm like, I guess I'm just not good at bikes. I don't know what to say.
So has Bridget been commenting and getting your DMs and giving you tips at all?
So I'm actually coaching Bridget right now. So she's been, you know, giving me some tips on how to wheelie. I give her the training tips. She gives me the wheelie tips. It's a harmonious relationship. It's great.
Have disc brakes affected rear wheel modulation in wheelies? There's my tech question.
That would be a good question for someone who is trying to learn how to wheelie before 2020.
Or someone who understands how to do disc brake modulation.
That's right, yeah.
You brought up Bridget and you said you coach her. And so I know that you also are as a racer, you're also a coach for Cycle Smart. I'm just wondering, like, how has your relationship been with your athletes right now? And are you sort of imparting all these lessons you're learning? Like, what are they going through?
Oh, I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but one trend I've seen with lots of people is I think when all of the news and everything about coronavirus first came out, I think for a lot of people, there's a sense of like, oh, what am I training for? And then within a couple weeks, a lot of those people started going, wait, just like I realized, like, wait, you know what? I'm training because I like training. And racing is a fun side effect of that. But like we can set up other goals. So depending on where people are, we've had, like, I've been able to establish all sorts of different goals with my clients, whether it's doing Zwift racing or setting personal best on power, or in some places it's, you know, it's fine to be going after some Strava segments. Or if their goal is as simple, if they like, if they're a frontline worker and doing something really stressful, maybe it's, the goal is just to like take 3 hour sessions a week and focus on those and just doing these workouts to take your mind off of all of the other super hard work that you're doing throughout the day. So in some ways it's like, yeah, sports not around, but in other ways, the act of like being active and doing sport and focusing energy on that is almost more important than it was.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Well, I think that's kind of, I guess that was a question that I had, because it seems like from my perspective, you can do that for maybe a few training blocks. You know, do you think that that's going to change as we're getting into, you know, I think we're getting towards the edge of where everyone's getting kind of antsy. And it's, you know, part of why you do those 2x20s or 5x5s is because you do want to see results, or, you know, to put it to use.
Well, yeah, you just need to know what the goals are, right? So if your goal is to win a race, or get a podium in a race or finish a race or whatever it is, then, and that's the only goal, then yeah, doing those 2x20s, like you said, is going to get pretty onerous at a certain point in time. But if we can reframe some of those goals to be oriented around something else, like I have clients who we switch their goals. They've always had this 400 kilometer route that they wanted to ride. It's like, okay, like we're training to ride that route now. Has nothing to do with racing and has nothing to do with anything else. But now it's just the accomplishment is like doing that activity. Or other people who they just want to keep up with, like I have a client who just wants to be able to keep up and ride with his kid. So we're focusing on that. There's nothing else to it. So it's like, yeah, if the goal was the race that's supposed to happen on June 1st, that's probably not going to last. But if you can get a layer deeper than that and start diving into like, why do people actually want to do something and start establishing that? So for me, if I look at my own racing, I'll use myself as an example. It's like, why do I want to be a cross racer? Why do I want to do the training? And it's because, well, I want to see how good I can be at this compared to the world's elite. And then when you layer things on top of that, right, you can start establishing short-term goals and longer-term goals. And at the end of the day, like, at some point in time, we can be pretty certain that racing as we know it will come back. We don't exactly know when that timeline is, but establishing these interim goals to get you to that point is, I think it's actually, it has a lot more value than people give it credit for.
I think you kind of answered this question, but I was just curious, what is like the one thing that you look forward to every day? Some sort of like small motivational tip. I mean, mine is like still, like I'm a bit lost myself in my schedules, but I like the coffee with my girlfriend in the morning is like what I go to bed for. I'm just curious, like what is that one thing or a couple of things that are really jazzing you? You know, it's like keep you going through this sort of uncertain period.
Yeah. That's a great question actually, and this sounds so like such a cyclist nerdy thing to say, but honestly, like going through and having a training plan and every day going off and like checking the box going, yeah, I did that. Like this was my big task today and I accomplished it. That gives me a lot of satisfaction. So if anything, like I'm typically in my career, I've followed my training plans pretty closely, but I haven't nerded out about them. I think over the last 7 weeks, I've been nerding out about them a lot more.
Are you your own coach or do you have someone else?
No, that never works very well. there's some athletes. It always seems like athletes, like at the end of their career, start trying to coach themselves. For me, I need someone else to tell me. I think a lot of people already know this. My coach, Al Donahue, he had a stroke in December or January, and he's recovering fine and he's doing really well. But obviously, he was he wasn't working for a little while. So all the other coaches at CycleSmart were helping out with some of the clients. And as part of that, I ended up coaching myself for about a month. And that was as long as I would want to do that. You just start, like, even though I know the answers for someone else, when it's to yourself, you start second guessing everything. So if I'm out on a training ride, it's always a question for me. It's like, oh, should I be doing more? Like I saw that, you know, rider X, like I saw that Curtis was doing this on Instagram. Maybe I should ride more. Maybe I should do more. And I think athletes either second guess themselves and ride too little, or they just dig themselves into a massive hole because there's no one there to say, hey, you did it. You're doing great. That's enough work. You can pull back now and recover. So no, I don't coach myself. I want someone else looking there and going, this is what you should do. I'm going to make the decisions for you. You just go do it.
One thing that's always interesting to me, or I guess I find it interesting, is, you know, you're both an athlete being coached, but you also coach. So to what extent do you draw on your experience, workouts that you're given, you know, learning from other people? How does that, you know, how do you incorporate that into your coaching and other people?
That's actually another really good question. So I try to draw a lot of my experience, but the challenge with that is you never want to assume that everybody is like you, both in terms of their, like, obviously I'm like reasonably good at this cycling thing. I have some genetic talents here. And because something works for me as an athlete, definitely does not mean it works for everybody else. Everybody has both different workouts that work for them, but also different amounts of work that they're willing to do leading into something. And everyone else has like a little bit of a different life situation. So I can't go and say like, hey, this I did 20 hour weeks for 4 weeks and I had this great cyclocross season. And here I have client X who's working 9 to 5, but he should really be doing 20 hour weeks. Like that's totally going to work for him. And that's obviously like a really exaggerated example, but what I find is I take the technical and the race prep things that I've learned, and those skills are really applicable to everybody, but the actual physical training really needs to vary depending on the athlete. So it's almost, I try not to read into my own training too much when I'm doing that.
So in gravel cycling, like you look at like the Ligands, you know, they have a very holistic approach to, you know, you get both the physical as well as like, here's how to prepare, here's how to pack your bag. You know, for cross, do you do some of those kind of softer skills in terms of like how to prepare and how to be ready to race? Is that a part of, you know, what you're offering?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You always go after the lowest hanging fruit first, as, and I think anyone should do that, whether you're a business or a coach or an athlete. Like if you have, so what I try to break down is like, I want to make sure that athletes are showing up to the race prepared. And that takes so much less time to perfect that than it does to build this massive aerobic base or to build that top end power that you need to compete or to build these hours of technical skills. Like if we can just start by having someone to the race at a good time with enough time to pre-ride with all the stuff they need in the bags with a routine that can get them into a good headspace, that's a good starting point, right? They're going to have better, it'd be a way better usage of time to do those things than would be to spend every possible second doing on the bike training and not touch on those. I think if you did that, you'd have an athlete showing up to a race 45 minutes before unprepared, too high of tire pressure, not knowing what to expect on the start grid. Focusing on those softer skills, I like to do that in conjunction with, but also as a top priority.
More coaching stuff?
Did you get any coaching before jumping into the media pit and talk to Becca or someone to prepare for this?
No. So Bill and I did a podcast probably like 4 years ago.
I remember that.
I think we did, right, Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did an interview. So that's it. I'm just basing it solely off that. I listened to all the rough drafts in preparation for the media pit. over the past week, I covered episodes 1.1 to 1.5. 1.5. Yeah. Up to 1.5. So I'm up to speed on that. I think I probably listened to all the media pits, actually. I listened to the Becca one.
Good.
And very quickly realized that I am neither as funny or entertaining as Becca. So I'll have to make up for it by being really nice, I guess. But Becca's pretty nice too. This will be tough.
Well, let's change gears a little bit. I want to just talk about, especially since, you know, it has been a while since we chatted officially. Just looking back, you know, I don't know where to start this. Part of it is you refer to yourself as, oh, the old man. I mean, you're 27, right?
Oh, it's so weird to be the old man all of a sudden. I think maybe this is how it happens in everybody's life, but I felt like there were years on end where I was like the up and comer. And maybe there was 10 minutes where I was middle-aged and then immediately I was old. Is that a normal thing?
Yeah, yes. But in the same sense, because just looking at it, like racing career really getting going, ended 2011 into 2012, you know, so you've been at this close to a decade now at the top level, but you're still not that old. You know, I I mean, how do you feel about that? Where do you think you are? Do you feel like you still have room to improve in your career? I feel like talking to you, and I may be completely off base here, like this last season maybe wasn't where you wanted to be. I mean, out there, they're racing, and what's it for you going forward?
Oh, for sure. So I think people, it's great that you said that, because I think a lot of people look at my last season and go like, hey, you had a good season. And I guess I go like, objectively, sure, it was as good as the season before and probably better than the season before that. But part of my process as an athlete anyways has been starting to realize what I can do. And for a long time as a racer, I was happy with doing okay. I don't know how to say that. We'll go a step further. I think there are lots of racers who are really, really extrinsically motivated and want to win races really badly. And obviously as a racer, I have a lot of that, but I fall a little bit more than most people into the intrinsically motivated part, where I really like the training and I really like the racing as a way to just go out and really, really push hard. And I think for a long time in my career, I was happy just going out and trying really hard. But what I've started to realize more of the past few years is my best race and me doing my best is me winning. I'm as good, and other people can choose not to agree with this, but I believe it. I'm as good as anyone else racing in North America. So my best race is me winning a race.
And that's where we were. That was, I think, the conversation that we had. And that was kind of the first that I heard you really say that, where you're showing some frustration in that, you know, you look at this year, especially domestically, where you have Kerry and Curtis who are sort of battling it out. And you were like, in the races you were there, I think that's where you were like, those are the guys that I need to be with. Those are races I can win.
And I totally agree. And it's not necessarily because I have this burning desire to beat Kerry and Curtis. Of course, right, I want to do that. But it's because I know that if I execute what I am capable of doing as best that I can, I will win races. And maybe not every race, but I will win races. So you're right in the sense that, like, a lot of times last year, I just wasn't there. And there's lots of reasons for that. But I think in a lot of ways, the process of not being there and the frustration that I was feeling is going to be really important as a springboard to take me to what's hopefully the next level where I am winning those races moving forward. And that frustration is actually something that's pretty new to me as a racer. Like I was saying, there was a lot of years where I was doing well, and of course I wanted to win, but I was mostly just happy going out and like, trying hard, as weird as that sounds to say coming from an elite athlete. As I'm maturing as an athlete, I'm realizing that I want to keep on improving, and I want to get past that point to the next level. And even if we expand that horizon to World Cup racing and to the World Championships in Fayetteville, I know that I want to get a top 10 in Fayetteville. And I think to lots of people that seems crazy, but to me that seems like, if I do everything that I can and I execute it well over the next 2 years, that's realistic. That would be me sort of living up to what I think I'm capable of.
Yeah, and that's, you know, sort of as a follow-up to that, you know, I think a conversation that we had when you were living in a dorm room in Hoogerheide and I had a palatial suite below you, and took advantage of everything that had to offer. If you all don't know these the rooms that they had in Hoogerheide, whatever it was, like for Cliff, we got this huge room, and then all of the poor Canadians were in these tiny little closets above us in the
Wi-Fi that only worked from the hours of midnight to 7 a.m.
sounds about right.
So this is so far, we're getting off topic here, but that was so much better than some of the accommodation that we've had on these Worlds projects. So I love this Canadian cyclocross programs. Like, it feels like we're all in it together. And Scott Kelly does an awesome job of organizing it. But definitely earlier, there was a big push from the athletes, like it's our fault, from the athletes to make them as cheap as possible. And some of the places that we stayed at, like in Luxembourg Worlds, it's like, I was rooming with Jeremy Martin, former national champion, and he had one of these big Ewok rolly bags, but we could not move around our room unless his Ewok rolly bag was on the bed. So then when, like at nighttime, he would take his Ewok rolly bag and he would put it on the floor and then we could sleep. But as soon as he got up, if he wanted to like get to the bathroom, he'd have to take his bag and put it back on the bed. Like that's how big it was. We were probably sleeping like all of 4 inches away from each other. And people are like, oh, that's just a European hotel. But no, I've stayed in Ibis Budgets and this was the next level. It was called Premier Class, and it was like Ibis Super Budget.
These are the you're a professional cyclist stories that we come here for.
Exactly. Yeah. But so from getting a little bit more on track, what I think from just chatting with you during that time, you really, I got the feeling that you were really comfortable with that style of racing, with racing in Europe, that you felt like of North Americans, you kind of had a pretty good handle on what needed to be done to succeed in those conditions. So I guess a two part question here is there something that, you know, getting away from home, getting away from that and just being dedicated to racing that helps? And then on top of that, Is that something that your schedule going forward may change, you know, assuming we get back to full on racing, where you may do longer stints in Europe to try to just work up into that field?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, partly because I try not to spend too much time thinking through the scenarios of what cyclocross might look like in the fall, but you know, you can't help but to a certain point. And part of me wonders, like, is the World Cup going to be one of the only series that's running in full? Maybe. It doesn't seem unrealistic, right? It's lower, like, of all the series, that's the one that they could theoretically do without spectators and without having 1,000 people registering for the event. So I definitely have been thinking about that. And in general, like, if I go dig into my power numbers and everything, it's pretty clear that racing heavy courses with extended pedaling sections is what I'm best at. And I think you don't even need to do that. Bill can probably, and Zach can probably see that, you know, I can probably see that just watching me race. Not terribly snappy, but if we get to a heavy slog, like what, you know, Fayetteville, Ruts and Guts, whatever, I'm way more comfortable with that. And part of that's just my physiology. That's like those type of efforts are what I'm good at. And then I'm also just really comfortable in Europe. I really think that the newer class of American riders is much, much better for this. But there's a few years, I think, where there's just this super toxic idea among all the American pros that Europe was terrible and no one wanted to go there. And you guys probably remember that, like, Ryan Gerbone always hated going to Europe and Jamie doesn't like going to Europe. And it seemed like at the end of his career, Tim didn't like going to Europe. And I feel like that, and they had reasons for that, but I feel like that attitude kind of swept down through the ranks. And I just never, like, I love racing in Europe. It's you feel like, I don't want to diss American cyclocross at all, but like you feel like a professional athlete. There's mm-hmm. thousands of fans cheering you on. They're thumping on the barriers at Digum. Like, you feel like a pro. And that doesn't always happen when you're racing through a field in Midwestern US, even though the competition level is super high and the people putting on the race are awesome and your sponsors do care about those events, it just doesn't replace the having 30,000 spectators around it. And that's something that I've always appreciated there. And then I just, I think it's a really relaxing place to be. Like, maybe this is because I'm Canadian and the weather sucks here anyways, so I might as well go somewhere else where the weather still sucks. But like, the pace of life in Europe is a little bit slower. And when you're there, knowing that you're there just to train and just to race your bike and just to prepare for these events, I think is a step away from, even though I'm an athlete who, you know, doesn't do anything besides coach and race my bike, there's still so many other responsibilities that you have at home. Just because you're at home, it's not a bad thing. But taking those trips where the only purpose is to focus on preparing for the next race as best you possibly can, I really value that time.
Yeah, and just seeing, I mean, spending some time with Team Canada, at least on that last trip. I mean, it's such a it's such a great environment. I mean, it's super positive. Everybody's having fun. You find places that aren't too far from the venue, so you can actually, you don't have to worry about, you know, traveling and everything else. And I'm a little biased. I'm friends with Scott and just, you know, love hanging out with those guys. But I think just from that leadership level down to all of you and the riders, you know, especially like witnessing you all like at your team dinners and that kind of stuff. It's a really good vibe. And I think that helps a lot.
Oh, I totally agree. It's awesome to be like, I really like those people. And I think the amount of times that you hear something like Europe sucks among Team Canada is next to none. Like we all like being there and we want to be there and we want to compete there. And again, I don't know if this just comes down to the fact that like, hey, the weather sucks in Canada right now, so we might as well be here where the weather still sucks, or if there's more to it than that. But everyone from the juniors up to the mechanics, like people don't know this, but all the mechanics on Team Canada are, one, the best people in the world, and two, they volunteered to be there. Like they're there because they really care about the sport and because they want to be there. And that's something super, super special. Like I wish that we could pay them what they deserve, but it's also so incredible to know that like, no, these guys are here because they love the sport and they want to see Canadian athletes succeed. And we, it's not like we're putting together a ragtag group of mechanics either. Like these guys are, Scott Kelly's a pro mechanic. We have like Adam Trotter's the downhill mechanic for Canada. The list just like, it goes on and on. We have people that have done 10. Yeah.
Even your non-Canadian.
Yeah. Drew's an honorary. Drew loves us so much that he comes to join Canada instead of the US.
Well, I think though, like the, you know, what you guys have, I think addresses two of the issues that, you know, I came across in whatever, three seasons of working at Cyclocross Magazine. And one is that Europe is very isolating, you know, and we've seen a lot of people not really adapt to that really well. But two, you know, the Euros have like this team vibe, right? Like, I mean, they'll go home, but they have their campers, they train together and stuff. And it seems like you guys have really dialed in solving two of those huge problems. And it sounds like maybe why you've adapted to it so well is because you've kind of solved. It looks like fun. It looks like from the outside you guys are having fun, and it seems to have addressed those two pretty big issues.
For sure. Yeah. You have to make it a fun environment, and you have to remind, like, this seems really silly, but you have to remind yourself that it's a fun environment. Like, also, as soon as you start getting those ideas that, like, oh, the weather sucks and this is hard. Yeah, it turns out the weather's actually going to suck and this actually is really hard. But you go in with a mindset, and this is what Scott and the Canadian Cyclocross program has done a really good job of, and maybe just even past riders going back and telling the future riders about it, is like, no, this is fun. We're going to go do this, and we're going to do this as a group. And there's been a really good onus, especially for the younger riders. And like, no one cares what result you get. Just go out there and learn something and do your best. And yeah, for Megs and Mike and Ruby, and like, they're trying to get good results, but everyone else just like, watch them, have fun at the races, learn a bunch. You're going to get there. Don't worry about it. And I don't know. I haven't been a part of the US program. I haven't been a part of the Netherlands program or the Japanese program, whatever. I don't know what it's like and for other places, but I think you're right. Like, I think we have a really healthy environment for the athletes, and we get along and we enjoy those trips, and hopefully, and just watching some of the athletes race there, like, hopefully there's going to be people like Megs and like Ruby and like who knows what athletes coming up who are starting to get those podiums at World Cups or winning World Cups or World Championship medals or whatever that's going to be. And I feel like it's, if we can keep that going, it's almost inevitable that that happens.
You know, Jen's going to listen to this, so I'll let you. I think you forgot someone.
Oh yeah, Jen Jackson is.
I don't want to get in trouble with your teammate.
Well, but actually,
no Jen, cookies for you,
Jen.
No cookies for me,
Jen Jackson, who we would love to do as much cyclocross as possible. That's, it's actually one of those things that I wanted to ask. As much as we're singing the praises of Team Canada, which I think is awesome, I think even more than the U.S., the emphasis on mountain biking in Canada is even bigger, and that there seems to be, you know, I mean, that's an Olympic sport, that funding follows the Olympics. We all talk about that down here a ton. I mean, what's there seems like there's even a little more tension in keeping people focused on cyclocross in Canada than there may be in the US.
Yeah, it's a tough mix for sure, because like you said, funding follows the Olympics, rightly or wrongly. I think that's a really long discussion that if we run out of topics, we can certainly talk about. But funding follows the Olympics, so that makes it really tough for athletes like Jen, like Emily Johnson, who's a really good Canadian junior. Anyone with Olympic aspirations, it can be really tough to go on and dedicate yourself to cross, because I don't know exactly how it works in the States, but in Canada, you're eligible for something called karting. And karting basically is set around mountain bike or road criteria, Olympic sport criteria. And if you meet those criteria, you get tax-free money every month. Like it's the best way to make money as an athlete in Canada. It's not a ton, but it's enough that you can cycling dirt bag your way through life and be a pro bike racer. And obviously that karting criteria doesn't follow cyclocross around because it's not an Olympic sport. But I do think that among younger athletes right now, we're not going to get the Pete DeSeres to race cyclocross outside of the odd event. And that's fine because he's a legitimate top 10 in the World Cup racer. He's doing his thing and he's best at that thing. And he's not going to be a top 10 racer at cyclocross World Cups. They're different enough sports that he sort of found his niche and he's being really successful at it. But one of the things that we still can do as a country, even with that tension, is a lot of the younger athletes coming up, there is no junior mountain bike World Cup. Even the U23 mountain bike World Cup can be really tough to get to for a lot of athletes. So you look at a sport like cross and you look at a block like the Christmas cross period, and you have two World Cups and three other events that are bigger than any event that these juniors have done. And it doesn't matter if they're mountain bike racers or cross racers, just going to that event and preparing for an event that big and having a start with that many other juniors, that many other riders at that high caliber of event. Even if you only race a couple years of junior cross and then go to mountain bike, or maybe you fall in love with cross and you make it your whole career, doing that's going to help you in the long run, regardless of what your big outcome goals are. And that's something that Cycling Canada has been coming around to a little bit as well. I think there was a long time when it was like, no, you're a mountain bike racer, you shouldn't be racing cross. And thank goodness for Matthew and Wout, because I think they maybe showed the world, they're like, hey, so you could actually be good at multiple things at the same time. or Sagan or whoever, I was like, hey, you could start, or Alaphilippe, you could start in cyclocross, and then like, this is a really, really, even if you don't make this your career, this is a really, really good development sport, because the races are short and they're intense and they're bike handling focused and it's high pressure. If you can compete at a cyclocross race, you can show up and battle for position in a rib race.
Yeah.
You can go and you can learn mountain bike skills. Like that stuff will come.
Yeah.
So you're a multidisciplined star. You do cyclocross,
right.
And you've branched out into, making videos on the internet. I mean, gravel cycling.
Yeah, so the YouTube channel Mike Can't Wheelie is coming soon.
Do you think
that will get covered on the Rough Draft for sure?
You talked a little bit about how, this Canadian Federation is viewing it, but are you seeing a shift in athletes in terms of embracing, because it just seems like there's more acceptance of doing different things and like, hey, you can do more than one discipline and be successful. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you see athletes embracing as well?
Yes and no. I think you see a lot of athletes have their favorite discipline, be that mountain bike or cross or gravel or road or whatever it is, and then doing another discipline because they really like their favorite discipline that they focus on and have a lot of high ambitions in, and then another discipline that they just enjoy doing because it's fun. And I think that's where I fall into. I'm never going to pretend that I'm trying to peak for lost and found in the gravel season. Like I'm trying to race well. But ultimately, like the gravel season for me is something that I want to have a good time at and hang out with all these awesome people and maybe have two beers after the race instead of half a beer. And, I just really want to enjoy the cycling community during that part of my season. And when I get to cross, it's serious time. Like I love that too, but it's time to go to work and it's time to be serious and it's time to make a few more sacrifices. And I feel like other athletes are sort of in that similar boat. Like it used to be that people would race the serious road season and then go have fun at cross. and maybe that table's turning. Like, hopefully some people are going to race the serious gravel season and then go have fun at cross. But for me, I'm racing the serious cross season and, you know, having some fun in gravel, using it as great training, getting out and like seeing all these cool places in the world. I don't think it's a secret that you go to, oh no, I'm blanking on the place it is. But anyways, Lost and Found Gravel in California. And it's like, it's stunningly beautiful out there. Or you go down to the Mid-South and like, yeah, rural Oklahoma is pretty cool looking. It's open, it's red dirt. It's really fun to be there. And I think that list goes on for a lot of gravel races. So it's like, you can expand where you get to travel a little bit more and be out in the countryside. But for me, that's all still in the name of just enjoying my time out there and having fun. And maybe I'm 90%, but I'm not focusing that at 100%.
So if you had to do a third discipline, which one would it be?
Oh, for sure, knee slide Red Bull chugging. It's new. I think I could definitely get a medal at the World Championships.
You'd definitely be on Canadian's team.
That's right.
I mean, with hockey pads, you could get a lot more distance.
Very true. Very true. Oh, a third discipline. I wish I did BMX racing as a kid. Like, if I don't live close to a BMX track right now, but like, I hope one day when I have kids that if they like bikes, like, I'll put them in BMX racing. That seems like a great discipline and a super fun discipline. And I wish I did. Maybe I still will go back and do that. There's nothing wrong with being the old guy at the BMX track.
So if it weren't for coronavirus, you would be racing. You would be doing some gravel right now. This is gravel season. We just talk a little bit about the Easton Overland team and just sort of what that's about.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know how to sum it up in a sentence, but Easton Overland gravel team is, I'm already stumped. We're a bunch of people that really like riding bikes. That seems really, really simplistic to say, but that's genuinely the truth. Like, I look at my teammates and it's Amity who won Dirty Kansas last year, a couple cross races you guys would be familiar with, Caitlin Bernstein and Caroline, Dusendorf now, formerly Nolan. And Matt Lieto, and then a couple people on the media side. And like, we're all racing, but I think we all just really share the passion for like going out there and riding our bikes and being like, whoa, look at that. That was cool. So yeah, it's a bunch of people that like riding their bikes. That's what we are. We happen to be a team. We're definitely not too focused on the aero bar nerdy side of the sport at all. We're a little bit more focused on like, these events are cool. They're bringing a lot of people who maybe otherwise wouldn't be doing a competitive cycling event together. And it's just fun to be a part of that.
So no, like, no team tactics at the gravel race.
No team tactics. I think that any one of those riders that like Amity, Caro or Caitlin, if I tried to help them out in a gravel race, they might just like kick me to the curb. I don't know. They don't want that. We're not a team tactic gravel team.
I actually have I was curious about the tech side of things for you guys. Last year you were, I mean, obviously you're repping Easton Parts and Easton Wheels and stuff, but you guys were all on the Allied All Road and the Allied Able Made in America bike last year. But this year it's kind of, you get to pick your own, or it's a little bit hit and miss because you're on the Revolt this year, right?
That's right. So something that I really appreciate that Easton did this is one of the big challenges with cross, I think, is that most cross teams don't have a 12-month program. Actually, there's not really very many cross teams anymore, I guess. But anyways, my cross team doesn't have a 12-month program. Cannondale doesn't really have a 12-month program. There's a few athletes that are like Kona, I guess, does. But I was never super happy. As much as I loved my allies, I was never super happy going from riding bike. It was a Garneau then. And then all of a sudden, come March 1st, I'm riding an Allied. I want to be involved with my partners at more of a level with that, partly because I believe in the bikes that I ride, but also because I have relationships with the people that work at those companies and I like those people. I want to support them. I think it's like it's not a sponsorship, it's a partnership. So one of the things that Easton was wanted to do this year was basically let the athletes take these companies that they have relationships with. For me, that's been Giant, and I've only been with them for a year, but like I said, like I really like the people that work at Giant Canada and Giant US, and we've developed a great relationship, and like, oh yeah, it helps. The bikes are really nice. And carry those sponsors forward into the gravel season. So you're seeing myself on a Giant, you're seeing Amity's riding Canyons, and you're seeing, you know, Caro's on Cervelo and Caitlin's on a Da Vinci. You're seeing different people riding different brands that they already had relationships with. Because I think you guys have talked about this before. There's not that many cyclocross teams anymore. And part of the reason is because it's tough now for a brand to see Instagram and see social media and see all these things that are so individual based and then go and say, okay, so we're supporting seven riders when, you know, maybe they're concerned about the relationship they have with one or two of those. So this gives us the opportunity to still have that team environment and still really enjoy being on a team and spending time with these people and share some of those resources, but also still build the relationship with those brands that we already have relationships with.
Yeah. Sounds like a pretty unique model. And I mean, that's pretty cool. And I think one of the things that also stuck out to me was that you guys sort of, like you said, have in-house media. I know one of the guys, the filmmaker guy, I only know him by his Instagram handle, Ride Gradient.
Ride Gradient. Yeah. Nick Kupiak.
Yeah, does some great photos and video, and I just kind of put it together doing some research that he's like doing work for you guys, and I saw one of the videos, and it's good stuff. And I think that's like, that's obviously, I'm a filmmaker, like that's my dream, like working with the team, and that's a smart way to really like A, have good quality content, and B, have it like ready to go and like have it for your athletes to push out.
Yeah, it turns out the photos from my iPhone 7 just don't cut it anymore, eh? Yeah, I agree. I mean, one, Nick is actually a super good rider too. He's so going this ride ready, going with on a photo shoot with Nick basically means that you're riding at the pace that you want to go. And he's also riding a bike with 30 pounds of camera gear and then sprinting ahead every 10 minutes and then stopping and taking photos and then sprinting ahead again.
Wow.
So the poor guy is like probably doing, you know, it's like going on a walk with your dog off leash. Like he's doing three times the amount of work that everybody else is doing. Just zooming ahead and falling back and zooming ahead. And so yeah, Nick's an awesome rider. And like you said, really, really good videographer too. He actually works for Easton and Raceface full time. And because he's in kind of the unique position and the team is really an Easton driven project, he comes along to a lot of the events, or would be coming along to a lot of the events that we're doing, puts together great little clips, and he also races them. So it's fun. It's fun to like have another person there to break it down with, and then also have someone who sends you these amazing photos on Monday.
Definitely.
So I don't have to go, you know, the old, I'm sure Bill gets this all the time. Actually, I'm sure you get this all the time too, Michael. The old like, hey, so I saw you take a photo of me. Can I have it? I've done that too many times in my career. I don't want to do it anymore.
Before we leave the topic of gravel, I really missed you at Dirty Kanza this past year. You know, I think we got to hang out in the cafeteria. You and Craig were there every morning for breakfast. Yeah. It was always good to see your smiling faces. Any chance you'll ever do the Dirty Kanza again?
is that sigh enough? I never... Never say never, as Justin Bieber say that. Maybe. As Canadian pop legend Justin Bieber once said.
Oh man, you're still young at heart, Michael.
As fellow Leafs fan and Canadian pop legend Justin Bieber once said, it's probably not even his song. It's probably just something else entirely. But anyways, not in the near future. And I learned firsthand that doing 12-hour, 13-hour, whatever it is, gravel events, and even though it's 3 or 4 months later, then racing a cross season, they turns out those are really different sports. No one told me that 12 hours and 1 hour were different, but turns out they are. Newsflash, not the same sport. So that was a little bit long for me. I I like in that race, probably from, I got to the last checkpoint and it was like a block headwind basically for the 3 hours before that. And I knew it was going to be a headwind for like the 3 hours after that. I remember sitting in a chair and Dylan Postier, the team manager for Eastern Giant, was out there helping us. And he was like, first off, he had Mike sitting in the chair, not wanting to go in. And he's like, Mike, like, you need to start racing again. You've been here for 10 minutes. I'm like, no, I don't want to, Dylan. Like, I'm happy here. And then I remember sitting there thinking, like, okay, it's only four more cross races. And then realizing, I was like, wait, it's only four more cross races? Like, that sounds terrible.
Oh, my God.
That's it. And being out there and being like, if I didn't know that there were 1,800 other people who are less fit than me who are going to finish this thing just because they think it's important. Like, if I didn't know that, I would quit right now. But because I know that there are all these people who are going to be out there for 20 hours and they're going to do it because they want to do it, it's like, I finished that race because I felt obligated to finish it, you know? So I would like to go back to Dirty Kansas at some point in time and maybe give it another crack and see how that goes. But I will never underestimate how hard it is again, and I will never do that and try to race a full cross season simultaneously. It'll be a post-cross career thing if I do go back. Right now, my cap is kind of like six-hour gravel events. So, kudos to everyone who does that thing, and super kudos to Jake Wells and those people that do DK350 XL or whatever it's called. That's, you have a special kind of suffering and motivation going on there. I think the hour's enough for me. I did that race in Trek and it was like 77 minutes and that felt a lot like Dirty Kansas. So I was getting a little bit too close.
So speaking about people who, you know, maybe not understanding one sport isn't, or one discipline isn't like another, what do you think about Wout Van Aert preparing for road season by going out for a 6 mile run and putting in 735 miles?
there are people, and then there are Wout Van Aert and Matthew, and all of the rules. Like, we talk about, we have Cycle Smart coaching calls every week, and we talk about this. And every now and then, someone will say like, oh well, Matthew did this, and we'll have to stop and be like, yes, but Matthew is not most people. Like, Matthew, or well, like, these people are from this planet and the rest of us are from this planet. And what works for these aliens definitely doesn't work for us.
Well, yeah. And then like 2 days later, he's working on 5 second efforts and his top end. I mean, this guy is like the optimist of optimists here. He's just going all in as if he's just, you know, like topping off the top end now and getting ready to race.
He has been wise enough not to say anything like Vanderpool did about being really bummed that there was no racing. That didn't go over super well from what I saw.
Yeah. So here's another one, something that Zach actually put in our Slack channel. So I want to know if your feelings on this that...
Oh, wait, there's a Slack. You guys just like throwing these prepared questions at me and I'm just...
No, this was for...
Just a guinea pig.
This was for secret Twitter. I'm just pulling this out... because it was on there, but it's just it was in Sporza talking about the season and Mehdi Penigan saying that he thinks that riders are going to... I love how he phrased this, and maybe it's just the translation. Riders will ask for less start money to make it possible for everyone to race and, you know, have it work out revenue wise. So are you a little shook up that the top end riders won't be getting their full start money?
I'm really concerned that my my 100 euros I got every fourth race will go down to 50 euros every sixth race. And it's pretty crushing in the grand scheme of things. I think I've raced in Europe probably for like 5 or 6 years now, and the disparity among the top and the bottom our start money earners is definitely not getting smaller. I'm getting the same start money I got when I was not, like, when I just showed up to Europe kind of out of the blue. And the figures that Matthew and Wout are getting are significantly bigger. And then you even go, and I don't have any real numbers on this, but you hear about what the, I wouldn't even call them tier two guys, like the guys who are just not Matthew and Wout are getting, and it's so much smaller. Like the pie is not split very evenly at all.
Well, they're the box office draws, you know, you get them there and you
there's a part of me that gets it. And there's a part of me that thinks like, maybe they are the guys that the TV cameras focused on. Like maybe there are just too many racers at a lot of these races. Like maybe cyclocross needs to have a Formula One style where there's like, what is it, 18 or 20 seats or something. And that's it. At the world level. And I don't know.
The thing that impressed me the most, having just being ignorant on the whole system, was as bad as in most instances on how Belgium is with the internet and how things work online. I don't know if you guys know this, but the system for getting start money,
amazing.
You sign up at this on a website. You just kind of put your name in that you're going to be at the race, and then they decide if you get start money, and then you just get, you know, it sort of checks you off and tells you how much start money. Like right. Brandon,
the website looked,
Brandon Fix was going nuts. He was like, look, made 100 euros starting this race. Yeah.
The website looks like it was made on like Microsoft Paint.
Sure.
But
yes,
it is a website.
Yes,
but no, it's actually, they have that part of it dialed. Like it's to be able to, one, go up and like do that start money website, and also when you get your start money, I give them my European banking info, and like a few days later it just shows up in my bank account. It's like, oh cool, I got my start money, problem solved. And that's how they pay out the World Cups, at least in Belgium. I think there's lots of riders who will tell you that they have not been paid from their World Cups in some other countries ever. What was that one in Italy? Fuji? The crazy,
yes,
like
the ice ball,
treacherous death course.
That may be Zach Nair's favorite World Cup ever.
the
poor
Fuji
Toon.
Ice.
If it didn't take out Toon, I would have, but anyway, so apparently, so the junior, I don't know if people know this, but juniors and U23s in those races get start money, and then the elite fields get prize money. And I think the start money for the junior U23 fields is like 100 or 150 euros or something like that. But in Fuji, Cycling Canada is there, and the next World Cup is Hogerheide in the Netherlands. So it's not that close. It's like, that's a pretty long drive. So they're all planning on leaving early Monday morning, but they get their start money in checks that can only be cashed at this one bank in Fuji that is only open on like Monday to Friday.
Oh man.
Oh,
that just sounds like the most, knowing what I know about Italy, that's just so Italy.
Yeah, it's like, we can't give you cash, but, you know, you could go to this one bank at between the hours of 10 and 11:15 and cash your check.
That's when you find an Italian rider and sign the check over and be like, give me some cash.
I think that's what they did at Eva Lechner or something. I think they pawned those checks off on her.
Yeah, and I think that may be actually what happens in the U.S. a lot with the European riders, where they're just, like, finding U.S. riders to sign over their checks to and, like, having them, pay them out.
Yeah, and they just, the when the Europeans come to America, it's great because, so this past year I was at Rochester and Dieter Sweek showed up, and he like, I know Dieter a little bit. We've chatted before. We were like Cross Vegas, and sometimes when I've gone to the forest in Belgium and Lichtart, he's like, let me ride behind him and Lawrence, which is great. Lawrence won't say anything to you. I think he just doesn't speak very good English. He seems like a nice enough guy, but Dieter's very, very friendly and speaks great English. So anyways, we're at Rochester this year and riding around, and I see Dieter. I'm like, oh, hey, like, I didn't see you. We're doing a lap together. And I'm like, oh, I didn't see you on the start list. And he's like, oh yeah, I didn't register yet. I'll just go to the sign-on table tomorrow and show up and they'll let me in. I don't, Dieter, like that's not how it works here. Like this isn't going to work for you. So I had to like, he didn't have a phone or anything because he was in the U.S., so I had to, like, phone up.
Is this Rochester?
No, I'm blanking on her name.
Shanna.
Yeah, to phone up Shanna, like, hey, I have Dieter here. Like, can he register for the race? He didn't do it yet. So she, like, gave me her email, and he ended up figuring out. He was able to race. But it was just really funny because he, like, it wasn't like he was showing up being like, oh, I'm Dieter Sweeper, let me in. Like, he just... like, yeah. Oh, we do it in Belgium. You show up the day of the race, they let you race. Like, if you don't have a start contract, it's fine. He just didn't know.
Yeah.
That, like, he didn't know you had to pay to race either.
I think you told me that story. I think on Friday we were talking and you were like, hey, so here's a funny story. I think you actually
I was trying to give you the scoop. I was like, hey, Dieter Smeek is racing. FYI.
The scoop.
Put this in your race report.
Last minute entry.
Yeah.
Not a leader, Swick.
So this is my theory, because this goes back. Bill told me that he has the one photo in the world where Lawrence Sweek is smiling at an American, and he's smiling, or the Canadian, and he's like looking over his shoulder and grinning at me. And my theory is that, like, I helped out Dieter, so now I'm in good with the Sweek man.
I don't know. They seem like good people. Like, a couple of years ago, their parents were at Jingle Cross. I remember the night race back when it was on the Sunday, and Lawrence had won the Sunday night race, and the whole family was there celebrating. And yeah, I mean, he seemed like really friendly and happy enough, just didn't necessarily have the English that his brother does.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely what it is. Like, Lawrence seems like a friendly enough guy. I don't think he speaks great English. And same thing with his dad. His dad, they looks like the most stereotypical Belgian man in the world, but friendly person. Very friendly person. So you haven't asked anyone how to save cyclocross yet, Bill. Isn't that like the question in every interview?
We could. I mean, if you... Okay, we only got like 1 minute left.
Oh, no.
Until we need to sign off here in the media pit. So in that 1 minute, since I've been asking everybody else on these shows recently... How are you going to solve cyclocross?
I know. I led into this question and people would have assumed that I had a really good answer for it. And I don't, which is sad. But I have been thinking about this lots, because turns out I've been riding my bike alone a lot. Lots of thinking time. I don't know. But I've been spending lots of time watching sports documentaries because of The Last Dance and because of Drive to Survive. And Drive to Survive has been one of my favorite episodes. And it just gets me thinking, and this might be a terrible idea. My wife thinks it's a terrible idea. But what if the World Cup was smaller, with like 20 riders only, and then everybody else just stayed home and raced their local series, be that the Belgian series or, you know, the Belgian-Dutch series and the America series and the German-Czech series or whatever it is? Would that be more engaging? Like, would the World Cup, would the people who did the World Cup actually do all of the World Cup because the seat there was so valuable, and maybe actually get more support, even if you were the 20th, or say it's 30 riders, the 30th placed person? And would that make every other series better because you had all of the best people who weren't there? And maybe there's some sort of like system like the Premier League where the worst 10 get bumped out of the World Cup the following year, and then people from various series get the opportunity to go race up. I don't know. Just, it might be a terrible idea, but it's been bouncing around my head.
I like this. I like the whole idea of cyclocross relegation.
Yeah.
It's I
like mid-season relegation.
Mid-season relegation. It's the reason it might be a terrible idea is because I don't think it helps me out at all.
Well, would there be... So
that
would
means
it just...
it's a good idea because you're not thinking just about yourself. You're thinking about the overall health of the sport.
Would different nations would different nations get slots, or would it just be rider based?
I don't know. I have no idea at all. You'd assume that like there'd be some auto spots for like the, you know, the Pan Am, the Euro champ, the whatever champs. Like, you want them in your World Cups. Maybe national champs get auto spots in the World Cups, or maybe that there's too many countries in the world that dilutes it too much. I don't know.
I think you're onto something though. Like, what if it was like X number of bids per country, and the way to make the local back home regional racing better is like you're vying to try to take those spots. So then it would be like super cutthroat at all levels.
Like, why do we need 80 people at a World Cup? That's my question. And I say that on one hand, and on the other hand, I'm like, well, I got to do a lot of World Cups being the, you know, the 40th or the 50th person. And there's a lot of other riders who, like, that's their career goal, is to go race the World Cup. So it's tough to see that. But then you also look at other sports. Like I said, I watched a lot of Drive to Survive, and you go, huh, they have this tiered system of F1, F2, F3. And it kind of makes sense. Like, when you're on that, when you're watching that show, you know, or watching the F1 series, you know, every single rider or every single driver who's in there, regardless of whether they're getting first or 20th, you know who they are. You kind of know their story, you know, their best results, you know why they're important. And I don't know if that's a model that works for cyclocross. I don't know. Maybe it's not a big enough sport, but just thinking out loud, basically.
I like it. I think it's a good idea. I like that you have solved cyclocross without mentioning the USGP, so you get kudos for that.
And well, he's Canadian.
No, don't ruin it.
Don't blow it.
I'm not going to mention. I'm not going to mention the shall we not be named series. But don't get me wrong, a national series would be great. But we have to ask ourselves: there have been national series and they disappeared. What are they like? Is having another one going to do the same thing, or do we need to look a little bit harder at like something about this model isn't working? We need to figure out a slightly different model. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the next national series, whatever that is going to be like the one that sticks around for 30 years. But I don't want another show air thing that's around for 1 year and we all get super excited about, and then it dissolves into thin air and it's like, oh, well, that was fun while it lasted.
I agree. Mike Vandenham, thanks so much for joining us here in the media pit.